Okay, sorry, sorry, oops, part of that delay, let's see here. There we go. Okay, sorry for the technical issues here. We're back up and running. Okay, so a subspace is a, once you're living in a vector space, a subspace is going to be a special set of subsets that's closed with respect to the fundamental vector space operations, scalar multiplication and vector addition. And then we've uncovered that there's two basic prototypes for a subspace. One way you can make a subspace is by taking it in a bunch of vectors and then considering all possible linear combinations of those vectors. Now, by its very construction, it's going to be closed under these two operations because these two operations are used to make every single vector in that set. And so, in fact, this is the first type of subspace where we actually have achieved finding a method for finding a basis for it. But the basis in general is not going to be the original set of vectors. Usually you're going to have too many vectors in that set. And so if you have a sort of too many vectors describing your subspace, your goal will be to eliminate some of the vectors so you get a good set that's capable of giving you good coordinates. A second way of producing a subspace is by solving linear equations. Homogeneous linear equations where on the right-hand side you have the zero vector. All right, so what we discussed on Monday's lecture was how to find a basis for a subspace of this first type. So let me remind you quickly what a basis is. It's a special set of vectors, all living inside the subspace, but it's a relatively small set. You only want to have as many vectors as you need to reach every point of this subspace. So if you have a list of vectors, maybe four or five, it depends on the actual size of the subspace, then we'll say you have a basis if whenever you have a vector that lives inside that set, that you can express it as a linear combination of your given list with unique coefficients c1 through ck. So it's the utility of the basis is because it gives us coordinates. What are our coordinates for vectors that live inside a subspace? What we do is we use these unique numbers to specify a given vector that lives inside a subspace. And those will be good coordinates. Two vectors will be different if they have different coordinates. But the coordinates are somehow a representation of the vector living in a different subspace. If these vectors, if S is a subspace of, say, R10, each of these vectors is going to be a 10-dimensional vector. But I may only need k parameters. Maybe k is 4. Maybe I only need 4 parameters to reach every point in that subspace. Well, that's the utility of the basis. It gives you a smaller set of vectors that still live in the subspace but are capable of reaching every point in the subspace and capable of providing you with good coordinates for every point in the subspace. All right, so here's the picture I want you to keep in mind. This three-dimensional box is, you're supposed to imagine is your general vector space, the space where all the vectors live. These blue lines represent an arbitrary set of vectors living in this space that's confined to this flat plane, which is supposed to represent a subspace sitting inside Rn. On this flat surface, we got a whole bunch of vectors. But the basis vectors are going to be even more special. They're going to be, in this example, there's only two of them because there's only two independent directions inside this, this subspace. Now, you don't necessarily have to take these red vectors as your basis vectors. Actually, almost any two of the original set of vectors will still provide you with a basis. What we're trying to do, though, is getting rid of all the superfluous vectors and so that we end up with good coordinates. Okay, so how do we find a basis for the case where we are just given a list of vectors and we want to find a minimal set of vectors that are capable of reaching every point in this space and such that the every point in the space will be uniquely represented by a linear combination of them? Well, what you do, as we saw on Monday, is we take these vectors and we write them as the rows of a matrix. Then we row reduce that matrix to a row echelon form. So we get the pivots occurring in a downward staircase from the upper left to the lower right. Then what happens then is those row vectors, even in the row echelon form, continue to generate the entire space that's generated by the original vectors. But if you, in the course of row reduction, you produce some zero rows, there's going to be some vectors that aren't really in the row echelon form that aren't going to contribute. The zero vectors aren't going to add anything to a linear combination. So this process of row reduction, in generally what it's doing is it's removing the redundant directions in the original set and reducing things down to a minimal set that was still capable of generating the entire subspace. And so the way we find a basis for a list of vectors is we write the vectors as the rows of the matrix, row reduced to its row echelon form. Then the non-zero rows will be a basis not only for the row space of the row echelon form, it'll be a basis for the row space of A, which is the same as the original space we started off in. Okay, so I'll do examples of this towards the end of the lecture when I'm going to talk about the other case of a basis and how we find other case of a subspace and how we find a basis for that. And then I'll do examples at the end of today's lecture. Okay, so that's when your subspace is presented to you as a span of a list of vectors. What if you're given a subspace by specifying it as a solution set of a homogeneous linear system? Here we're going to get a set of vectors living inside Rn that's going to be a subspace. How do we get a basis for that? Well, it turns out that if you know how to solve this equation, you know how to find the basis as well. And what I'll do is, rather than trying to explain this formally, let me just give you an example, reminding you how you solve such systems, and then I'll show you where the basis pops out. Okay, so let's look at this system of two equations and four unknowns. It's a homogeneous system because on the right-hand side, we have only zeros. Here's the coefficient matrix. When I append to it the column vector formed from the numbers on the right-hand side, I get the augmented matrix of the system. We solve the system by reducing this augmented matrix to, well, it's reduced row echelon form. So I'm not going to do the explicit row reduction. The first thing Long would have done was maybe subtract the first row from the second row to clear out that pivot, but there may have been other operations as well. Row reducing the original augmented matrix to its reduced row echelon form is the first step in finding the solution set to the system. Once you reach the reduced row echelon form, you convert back to equations because this guy is effectively the augmented matrix of the solution. So from this first row, we see x1 plus x4 has to equal 0, or simply x1 has to equal minus x4. The second row is telling us that x1 minus x3 is equal to 0, or that x2 is equal to 3. What I did here is I thought of the equation corresponding to each line in this augmented matrix, but I've also made a distinction between free variables and fixed variables. So here we have a pivot, here we have a pivot. So that means x1, x2, the two variables that correspond to those columns, these are going to be fixed. And meanwhile, the third column and the fourth column corresponding to the variables x3 and x4, these are going to be the free variables in the solution. So in fact, that's why I use the equations coming from the augmented matrix in reduced row echelon form Well, I use those equations to express the fixed variables in terms of the free variables. All right, so next step is then to write down a typical solution vector. What I'll do is I substitute where I can for the fixed variables. So in the first slot, I write minus x4 instead of x1. Second slot, I use x3 instead of x2. And then the last step here is to take this this vector and see how it could sit on a hyperplane. Well, here it is. You just expand in terms of the free parameters. So you'll have x3 has no component in the first slot, one in coefficient one in the second slot, coefficient one in the third slot, no coefficient in the last slot. Similarly for x4, we can pull that out. And now what we have is every vector that lives in the solution is going to lie in the span of these two vectors, right? These are x3 and x4 are arbitrary numbers. So by varying these vectors, these numbers, I get every vector that would occur in the set of all possible linear combinations of these two constant vectors. Moreover, not only is every solution vector a linear combination of these two vectors, notice that also that if you set the only way you can have the solution vector equal to zero vector is by having both x3 equal to zero and x4 is equal to zero. See, unless x3 is equal to zero, the sum of these two, this linear combination of the two vectors is going to be non-zero because there's nothing in the third slot that can be used to cancel the x3 times one. And so if the sum is going to equal zero, then we're going to need x3 is equal to zero. And similarly, looking at this last component, a multiple of this vector plus a multiple of this vector is not going to equal zero unless x4 is equal to zero, because there's nothing here that can cancel that one. So what you should observe from this is not only as soon as we represent the solution of this linear system as a hyperplane, we get it presented as living in the span of a particular set of vectors. And moreover, those vectors are linearly independent because we can't add them and produce a zero vector without taking both coefficients equal to zero. And they generate the entire set of solutions. So we have a pair of vectors that are linearly independent and generate the entire subspace. They're a basis. So in fact, these guys, these constant vectors that we've been finding all along ever since we've started solving homogeneous linear systems, turns out that those constant vectors are exactly the basis vectors for the solution set. So the answer to the problem posed, find the basis for the solution set of this equation. Well, we did have to solve the equations to do it, but as soon as we reach the solution set expressed as a hyperplane, then we've simultaneously found a basis for the entire solution set. Okay, and it's just these two vectors here, I stay our basis. They're exactly the vectors that occur when we expand a solution vector in terms of the free parameters. Okay, so I had two basic prototypes of how subspaces occur, either as the span of a set of vectors or as the solution set of a homogeneous linear system. I also on Monday talked about subspaces that were attached to an arbitrary n by n matrix, and they're based still of the same basic prototypes. We have the row space of the matrix that's defined as, well, the vectors, the subspace you get by taking all the row vectors of the matrix and taking all possible linear combinations of them. So it's a subspace of the first type. And so is the column space. The column space is also formed by, instead of working with the row vectors of the matrix, you work with the column vectors and you find all possible linear combinations of these guys. That's going to create a subspace. And then the third subspace that we can attach to a given matrix is going to be, well, you use the matrix as a coefficient matrix of a homogeneous linear system, and the subspace then attached to A is the solution set of the corresponding set of equations. Okay, so what I'm going to do next is tell you how you find bases for these three subspaces. Well, the first one, it's just the span of a set of vectors, so what do we do? Well, normally what we do is we write the vectors as the rows of a matrix, row reduce, and then grab the non-zero rows of the row echelon form. But in this case, the row vectors of A are already the row vectors of A. So I just row reduce A to a row reduce its row echelon form, or any row echelon form, and I grab the non-zero rows. That will provide me with a basis for the row space. To find a basis for the null space, well, what we do have to do is solve the linear system, AX is equal to zero, expand our solution set in terms of the free parameters, and then grab the constant vectors that are being multiplied by the free parameters of the solution, as in on the last slide. Then we have the last one, which is a basis. If you want to find a basis for the column space of a matrix, well, unfortunately, without a theorem that I'm about to state, you'll have to do a completely separate row reduction. In fact, what I hope you notice is that if you know you need to find bases for these two subspaces, you only need to do one row reduction, right? Just row reduce A all the way to reduce row echelon form. Then you'll be able to solve this and get the basis vectors for the null space. But you're also having produced the row reduced row echelon form is still going to be in row echelon form. So I could also grab the non-zero rows of the matrix in reduced row echelon form and use that as a basis for the row space of A. But the column space we have to treat a little bit differently, because if A is equal to A11, A1M, A N M. Okay, and just putting in the corner entries of this matrix. The way we found a basis for the row space, the span of all these row vectors, was by row reducing this to a row echelon form. But that it doesn't tell us anything about the column, the span of these column vectors. But what you could do to find a basis for the column space is you could take the columns and convert them into rows by doing the transpose operation. So this first column, A11 through AN1, I'm taking this column and I'm now writing it as a row. I'm taking the last column and writing it as the last row of a new matrix. So this would be 1M, ANM. ANM. All right, so I take a matrix, I convert it to a transpose, but now the column space of the original matrix is just the same thing as the row space of the transpose of the matrix. So what I would have to do, it's still a span, it's still a subspace created by taking all possible linear combinations of a given list of vectors. But our procedure for finding the basis for a span is to write the guys as the rows of the matrix. That's exactly what I'm doing here. And so what you would do then is you would take this transpose matrix and you put it in its row echelon form. And then you grab the non-zero rows. But once you get this matrix in row echelon form, the non-zero rows are going to be a basis for the span of the rows, which is the span of the original columns of the original matrix. All right, now, that means that I now have the means to find bases for each of these three subspaces, but it involves two separate row reductions, right? Row reducing A to its reduced row echelon form is going to give me this basis for the row space. It's also going to give me a basis for the null space of the matrix, but the column space, to get that, at this point of the game, we have to row reduce a different matrix. We have to take the transpose of the matrix before we do the row reduction in order to get the basis vectors. All right, so I'm going to improve upon that. Next slide. Here's the theorem. If you have any n by m matrix, then a basis for the column space can be obtained. Now, this is going to be different. We're going to not row reduce the transpose of our original matrix. I'm going to row reduce the original matrix itself to its row echelon form. But what I'm going to do is, once I reach this row echelon form, it's now different. I'm going to figure out which columns of the row echelon form have pivots. And then what I do is I go back to the original matrix and I grab the corresponding columns. And then what will happen is that let me give you an explicit example. What I'm suggesting here is that if you had a matrix let's say the row echelon form of A, once you've got it to row echelon form, say suppose you end up with a matrix that looks like this. 2-1, maybe something like that, I don't know. Suppose that's your row echelon form. Well, the statement, let's suppose the original matrix was 3-1-2-1, 1-2-1-0, 0-0-1-2. Okay, so suppose when you row reduce this matrix, you get this. I'm not going to work with this matrix directly until the very end. What you do to find a basis for the column space, if you take the original matrix, you row reduce it to its row echelon form, and you figure out where the pivots live. All right, so I got a pivot in the first column, the third column, and the fourth column. What I do to get a basis for the column space is I go back to the original matrix, and I grab that first column, I grab the third column, and I grab the fourth column. And then the statement would then be, having done this row reduction, I can now conclude that the column space of my matrix is going to have a basis for that. It's going to equal, here I have a pivot. I go back to the original matrix and grab the corresponding column, 3-1-0. Here I have a pivot in the row echelon form. I go back to the original matrix and grab the corresponding column. So that would be 2-1-1. And then here's a pivot in the row echelon form. I go back to the original matrix and I have 1-0-2. All right, and then that would be how you get a basis for the column space of this matrix, just using the row reduction of A, not the row reduction of its transpose, but the row reduction of A itself. You row reduce the row echelon form, figure out where the pivots live, but remember to go back to the original matrix. Those are the columns you're going to grab. Okay. All right, so what I've then described then is how to find bases for all three subspaces associated with a matrix by doing a single row reduction, by reducing your given matrix all the way to its reduced row echelon form. You use the non-zero rows of that reduced row echelon form as a basis for the row space. You use the columns, of the original matrix that correspond to the columns of the reduced row echelon form that have pivots. use the columns of the, those columns of the original matrix to get a basis for that column space of the original matrix. And then finally, you also use the reducible echelon form of your matrix A to write down the solutions of this and then grab the constant vectors that appear as you present the solution as being points on a hyperplane. The constant vectors being multiplied by the free variables in your expression of the solution, those are going to be your basis vectors. Okay, so let's do some examples. Here's a matrix with three rows and four columns. And I won't do the calculation, but my claim is that if you apply elementary row operations to this matrix, its reduced row echelon form is going to be exactly this matrix. And notice we have a zero row at the bottom here. That essentially means that there was some way of taking linear combinations of the rows of A and producing a zero vector. That tells you that the original rows were not linearly independent, rather they were linearly dependent, and we've removed a dependence relation effectively amongst them. And we're down to a pair of vectors, which are still going to generate the row space of A, but now we have a smaller list of generators. In fact, they're a basis for the row space of A. So all we have to do to get a basis for the row space of A is row reduce it to a row echelon form, or even a reduced row echelon form, grab the two non-zero rows, and that will be your basis for the row space. What about the column space? The column space, the way you find that is you look at the matrix in row echelon form and you figure out where the pivots live. All right, so they live in the first column and the second column. So I go back to the original matrix and I grab, I hope it's showing on screen here, I grab that first column because there was a pivot in the row echelon form, and I grab the second column as the second basis vector. And now I have a basis for the column space. The last subspace was the solution set of the corresponding linear system. So from this matrix in reduced row echelon form, you can see that X1 is going to have to equal minus X3 minus 2X4. That's coming from the first row. And X2 is going to have to equal 2X3 plus 2X4. I'm writing down the equation, then taking the terms that correspond to the free variables, I'm moving them to the right-hand side. And then I write down a solution vector. So I guess the next step that I skipped here in the slide would be to write a solution vector. Well, for the first component, it's going to be minus x3 minus 2x4. The second component is going to be 2x3 plus 2x4. The third component and the fourth component, they're free variables, so I don't change them. And then I expand in terms of the free variables. So I'll have x3 times minus 1, 2, 1, 0, plus x4 times minus 2 in the first slot, 2 in the second slot, nothing in the third slot, 1 in the fourth slot. And you see, now we've got every point in the solution set expressed as a linear combination of these two vectors. So the solution set is the span of these two vectors. And moreover, these two vectors are linearly independent. Why? Well, corresponding to this x3 parameter here, we have this non-zero entry here. And there's nothing over here that can cancel it. And similarly, corresponding to x4, we have an entry in that vector that cannot be canceled by anything from the first vector. And so there's no way I can get these two vectors to linear combinations of these two vectors to equal the zero vector without taking both x3 and the parameter x4 separately equal to zero, which means these vectors are linearly independent. All right, so the upshot of this is that once you've written down the hyperplane solution for the linear system, You've also identified basis vectors for that solution set. It's the constant vectors that occur when you expand the solution in terms of the free parameters. Okay, so that example, I gave you a matrix and I found bases for all three of the attached subspaces. All right, so the next thing I want to talk about, we'll do some more examples later in the lecture, I think, is some important facts about bases. The first one is that every subspace except the zero subspace has a basis. I mean, it's true, you can maybe think of the zero vector as a basis element, but the zero vector is not even linearly independent of itself, right? If I only had a single vector and I wanted to know if it was linearly independent, the question would be, can I solve x1, v1, plus, well, there's no other vectors to add to it. Can I solve this equation without taking x1 equal to zero? And of course you can, if v is just a zero vector, then no matter what I multiply zero by, I'm still going to produce a zero vector. So if you have a subspace that consists of only the zero vector, that's the one case where you don't have a basis. But in any other case where you have multiple non-zero vectors as a basis, then every subspace is going to have a basis. So long as it's not the single point at the origin. And then a second theorem about bases is that if you have a basis for a subspace, you could have different bases. All you really need, for example, to get a basis for the vectors that live on this blackboard, are two vectors that head off in independent directions. And then if I only have two vectors, I'll be able to reach every point on the blackboard by taking linear combinations of these guys. Geometrically, it just corresponds to realizing this point as a corner of a parallelogram that I formed from these original vectors. But I could have started off with two different vectors as well. And these two vectors, so long as they're pointing in independent directions on the blackboard, are still going to provide me with a basis. So you have many choices of bases, many choices of directions that are sufficiently independent that you can reach every point in your subspace by a unique linear combination. But even though you can have multiple bases, they all have to have the same number of vectors. And combining these two facts, that every vector except the point at the origin has every subspace except the origin alone has a basis, and the fact that every basis has the same number of vectors, that gives us the definition of dimension. The dimension of a subspace is the common number guaranteed by the second theorem, the common number of basis vectors in any basis for your subspace. Then, in fact, this even works when our subspace is a zero vector. If you have a subspace that consists of only the zero vector, it has no basis vectors. So by this definition, its dimension is zero. Okay, so that sort of justifies what I've been saying all along, individual vectors have dimension zero, but when you create sets of vectors by taking linear combinations, that's where you get infinitely many vectors, and that's where you're dealing with a non-trivial subspace. Okay, so let's see if we can count the dimensions of subspaces that we can attach to a matrix. So let's look at the row space first. The way we get the basis vectors for the row space is we row reduce the matrix to a row echelon form, and we grab the non-zero rows. So the dimension is going to equal the number of basis vectors you need to create the subspace. Well, in this For the row space, we just, the basis vectors correspond to the non-zero rows of a row echelon form. But put another way, if you have a non-zero row in a row echelon form, here's an arbitrary matrix, maybe here's, it's in row echelon form, so we might have a non-zero number here. But as soon as you have a non-zero row, you have a non-zero first term, and so it's going to have a pivot. And so basically, you can count the number of basis vectors for the row space by counting, simply counting the number of pivots you see in the row echelon form. And they're just going to, I mean, you're effectively just counting the number of non-zero rows, but you're also simultaneously counting the number of pivots. On the other hand, the column space, well, its dimension is going to be the number of basis vectors you need to produce that subspace. But the way we do that is for the column space, we row reduce a matrix to its row echelon form, and then we grab the columns of the original matrix that correspond to columns of the row echelon form that have pivots. So although I don't use the row echelon form as basis vectors, as far as counting the number of basis vectors, they're still good. In the row echelon form, say that's row echelon form of A, and let's say A is some other matrix, 1, 3, 2, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, same size as the original matrix. But what this would tell us is that the first basis vector for the column space of A, it's going to live in the first column. So this would be the first basis vector for the column space of A, and then whatever, I guess the X, no, 1, 2, 3, 4. So I have to go over 4, and then I better put in another column there. And this would be the second basis vector, because you go to the row echelon form, you figure out where the pivots live, and you go back to the original matrix to get the basis vector. But what you're doing, though, you have one vector over here for each column in the row echelon form that has a pivot. And so for each pivot, you have a basis vector. So what that tells us, you look at these last equalities, the dimension of the row space of A is equal to the number of pivots in a row echelon form. The dimension of the column space of the matrix, it's the same. It's the same as the number of pivots in a row echelon form. So let me show you why that's a little bit surprising. If you have a matrix A with m columns and n rows, then the row space of A, well, where does it live? Each row has m components, so it's going to be a subspace of an m-dimensional vector space. Meanwhile, the column space of A, well, if you look at a column, each column is going to have n components. So when we take the span of all the columns, we're going to get a subspace of Rn. So the row space and column space are subspaces, but they live in different vector spaces. So that's why this is a little bit of a miracle. This vector space, row space, lives inside Rm. The column space lives inside another vector space, Rn. Yet the dimensions of those two spaces, the two subspaces, are the same. So the column space, These two vector spaces, the vector spaces in which these subspaces live, are different. They have different dimension. But because they came from the same matrix, they actually, the corresponding subspaces also have the same dimension. All right, so that motivates a definition. I think I give it on the next slide, which is the rank of a matrix. You have an n by n matrix, then the rank of that matrix is going to be the common dimension, the row space, and the column space of the matrix. What it is, it's the number of basis vectors you have for the row space, or it's equal to the number of basis vectors you have for the column space. But both of these two numbers basically are reducible to the number of pivots you have in any row echelon form. So whether you are using the pivots to figure out which columns of the original matrix to use as basis vectors, or you're using the matrix in row echelon form, it's non-zero rows to get basis vectors for the row space. In both cases, you're going to get a basis vector, one for each pivot that occurs in the row echelon form. All right, so you now should have the wherewithal to actually begin to do the homework problems that are in problem set, what are we up to? I think six, I guess. So a new WebAssign problem set has been posted. What I want to point out here is that both the textbook and WebAssign refer to the dimension of the null space of a matrix as the nullity of A. But what this is, of course, is it's the number of free parameters in the solution set of AX is equal to zero, or it's equal to the number of columns in the reduced row echelon form that do not have pivots. That's equal to the number of free parameters. So the nullity of A is basically the dimension of the solution set of A times X is equal to zero. And let me do this again. Suppose A row reduces to a matrix 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. So it row reduces to that. Then let me describe the system. If we had a homogeneous linear system, AX is equal to zero, and then this would be the reduced row echelon form of that augmented matrix. So it would be the augmented matrix of the solution to this original linear system. We're used to counting columns without pivots as corresponding to free parameters in the solution. And columns with pivots are the fixed variables. So what I wanted to point out on this slide is that not only the pivots here, I count two pivots, I know that the dimension of the row space of the original matrix is going to be 2, and I also know the dimension of the column space of the original matrix is equal to 2, because I have two pivots in this reduced row echelon form. But I also know that I have two free parameters in the solution, so my solution set is going to be two-dimensional. And in fact, if you look at how these numbers add up, we have total number of columns is 4. So total number of columns in this example is 4. So I'm talking about the A part, not the zero column of the augmented matrix. So the total number of columns is 4. These you can divide up into with pivots and without pivots. And then if they have pivots, then depending on what you want to do, you can take any row that has a pivot, and you can produce a basis vector for the row space of the matrix. Or you can take a column that contains pivots, goes back to the original matrix, and grab the corresponding column. So pivot in the row echelon form is also going to lead you to a basis vector for the column space of A. And then the columns without pivots, they correspond to free parameters in the solution. In the solution set. And what that tells us then is The number of columns the number of pivots you have is actually going to equal the rank. So number of columns with pivots equals the rank of A. And the number of columns without pivots that's going to equal what the book calls the nullity of A. It's the dimension of the solution set of AX is equal to zero. And what these numbers tell you then is that the nullity of the A plus the rank of A always equals the number of columns of A. And so that's what I stated here. The nullity being the dimension of the subspace we get by solving the homogeneous linear system. Its dimension is going to be equal to the number of free variables, which is equal to the number of columns without pivot in any row echelon form. And so, number of pivots, number of columns without pivots, equals the number of columns of A. You always have this correspondence between the dimensions of the subspaces of a matrix. Whether I'm talking about the row space of a matrix or the column space of a matrix, its dimension plus the dimension of the null space of the matrix is always going to be the same as the number of columns of the original matrix. So, yeah.
Can you explain again why a dimension of the column space corresponds to the number of pivots?
Dimension of the column space.
Corresponds to
okay. So our rule for finding the basis was that, let me give you an example. 1, 2, 3, 0, 1, 1, 2, 1, 1. Suppose that this thing, so I'm not going to do the row reduction. Suppose that thing row reduces to 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 2. Suppose it, and maybe 0, 0, 0 down here. Suppose this was the reduced row echelon form of the matrix. So this calculation, where I take an arbitrary matrix and I calculate its reduced row echelon form, that's going to give me bases for all three subspaces. The way you get a basis for the row space, you look at the row echelon form and you grab the non-zero rows. So you're just going to use 1, 0, 1, and 0, 1, 2. To get a basis for the column space, and here's where your question comes in. The procedure I've told you use to find this is use this same row reduction calculation, but figure out where the pivots live, but then don't use these columns. This is what you look at first, but the idea is you go back to the original matrix and you grab those guys.
And why does that work?
I'm not proving that in this course. So it's a trick. So you do have a way of doing it by things I've proved. You take the matrix columns and you write them as rows and you row reduce, and then you could use that technique to get a basis. But this method I didn't prove in class, and I'm not going to try because it's hard, but it does work. The way you get a basis for the column space is you figure out where the pivots live, you go back to the original matrix, and you grab those columns. But because of the way I produce this list of basis vectors, I get one for each pivot. And so the counting stays the same. Pardon? I think it may be kind of abstract. One thing that is true, if you have a set of linearly independent vectors and they generate the same subspace, they're going to be a basis. And so I think the way the proof goes is you show that the vectors that you find this way are linearly independent and they generate the column space. But, and so you show two things. You show that one, that you can't add these vectors and come up with a zero vector without setting all the coefficients equal to zero. And separately, you have to show that these directions are enough to reach every point in the span of the original set of vectors. But we're not going to do that. But yeah, it's done more abstractly. And in fact, I think you do see the proof if you take advanced linear algebra. Okay, I'm sorry I've run a couple minutes over. So I'm just gonna point out that
you guys don't feel comfortable with that. I'm happy to put it down.
Oh, no.
Okay. Anyway, everyone knows no one is to be happy for running now.